Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Once a week, we take on a serious topic, generally not discussed in the mainstream media. Today, we're looking at a special investigation into the modern history and culture of Iran and its geopolitical standing in the Middle East. My guest today will be Professor Tom Ricks. He is a retired and distinguished professor who is now an independent scholar in modern Palestinian and Iranian society and cultural history. In the past, he has served on the faculties of the University of Pennsylvania, Villanova, Georgetown University, and Berzelt University in the West Bank, Palestine. He's published and edited numerous books, translations, and peer-reviewed articles during his teaching career, starting in 1974. In the 1960s, he served in the Peace Corps in Iran and is an expert on the life and work of Howard Bakersville, an American teacher who died alongside the democratic constitutionalists during the Iranian Constitutional Revolution in the beginning of the 20th century. He received his doctorate in Middle East history from Indiana University and continues to travel to Palestine yearly to teach at Beyerzelt University. He is joined with Fariba Amini, is a journalist who writes regularly on Iranian history and human and women's rights. Her father was the mayor of Tehran and a member of the ruling National Front Party and the personal attorney and close friend to the democratically elected Prime Minister Mossadegh, who was deposed by a U.S.-British-led coup in 1953. She's written and edited several books, including Faces of the Most Successful Iranian Americans, that was published by the U.S. State Department, as well as Letters from Ahmedabad, Mossadegh's Letters, and A Little Black Fish, a translation of children's stories by one of Iran's most famous storytellers. And she has degrees from George Mason University and a master's in history as well. Nice to have you both with us today.
Thank you, Gary.
A little later on in the program, I'm going to report on a new article, and it's an article that does tie in with our discussion. It is an article by Robert Perry from Consortium News, and it's entitled "The CIA Hand in an American Coup." Now, it begins by letting us know about the six decades that the CIA has been engaged in the Middle East in coups, and especially in Iran, when it had a democratically elected government in 1953, but it has never conceded it. It has never acknowledged it. To the contrary, virtually all of your neocons, conservatives, talking heads who support war efforts in the Middle East, our intervention in the Middle East, have denied this. And now there is hard evidence because it comes from the CIA itself. We even know the name of it, and this was called TPAJAX. That was the operational code name carried out in 1953, quote, as an act by U.S. foreign policy conceived and approved at the highest levels of government, end quote. In effect, the CIA, presumably meaning under the direct authorship of President Dwight Eisenhower, and they went against the nationalistic Mossadegh, who was challenging American-British allies over control of Iranian oil fields. And that prompted the concern that Great Britain wouldn't make as much money. So Great Britain interceded, put pressure upon the people in Washington, and they got their way. So a little later on, I'm going to show you that the very same agency, the very same people who were involved in the 1953 coup in Iran were also involved in another coup, and I'll give you the insight on that as well. But let's begin by first taking a look at what most Americans are unaware of. And if you don't mind, we're going to start with you, Tom, on this. Is that all right?
Yeah, that's okay.
Good. Last week, Fariba was on this program to speak about the recent declassification of CIA documents through the Freedom of Information Act, claimed by the National Security Archive, that confirms something most scholars have known for a long time that the U.S. was directly involved in deposing the democratically elected prime minister in 1953 in Iran, and that British U.S. orchestrated coup was followed by the installation of the pro-West Shah. We now know from the documents that the U.S. and the U.K. exerted considerable effort and energy and a great deal of funding for personnel, strategic operations, and payoffs in order to remove him. So I'd like to begin with you speaking about the importance of this historical moment and how the coup ultimately changed the face of Iran, contributed to it being the clerical regime it is today, a theocracy, especially since Mossadegh was perhaps one of the most pro-democratic, pro-free speech, pro-liberty persons Iran has ever seen. And yet, when you speak to or listen to any of the neocons today, they do not give you any sense of history about Iran. They make it seem like Iran is this extreme rogue state that needs to be annihilated. They are constantly suggesting that Israel, in its own defense and for its own security, must go in and take out all the nuclear materials in Iran and their defense mechanisms. And I believe that unless something is done, this could very easily happen, and that could set the stage for a conflict in the Middle East that we have never seen before, because Iran is not Iraq. It is not Afghanistan. These people are prepared for urban warfare, guerrilla warfare. They're much smarter than anyone you're going to find in the theaters of the Sunni and Shia and Kurds in Iraq. So I don't believe the average American has any consequence awareness. What could happen if we allow this to happen? So could you tie all this together, please? Give us the history. Give us to how we actually have created what is going on there now. The forum is yours. Take your time.
It's a huge subject, of course, Gary. But first of all, it's very clear that the event of August 19, 1953, the overthrow of Dr. Mossadegh, was and still remains a major political watershed in the relationships between Iran, by the way, and the United States. So any reference to any political warming up of relationships with the present Islamic Republic has to begin in part with that event. But it's important to understand, for Americans to understand, that this is a country that actually has gone through three major revolutions over the last 100 years. This is not a new event in 1953, nor was the Iranian Revolution of 1977 to 79 something that just happened yesterday, and was also a new event, and the Iranians were neophytes in the political forum of dealing with their government in open street demonstrations and in protests, either by demonstrations or newspapers. In fact, Iran has a history that goes back to the beginning of the century. In 1905 through 1911, the Iranian constitutional movement was actually underway, demanding that the Shah at that time live under a rule of equal justice, that there be a legislative body, we call it Majlis, that exists right till today. It started in 1905. It's unlike Iraq or Afghanistan. This is a country with a deep history of political culture and political confrontation and social movements. They're not neophytes. The importance of that constitutional revolution was that it actually went through a period where it failed partially, that it had to renew itself in 1907 through 8, and it did. So for the last 2 years or 3 years, we talk about the first and the second, that being the second phase of the constitutional movement. The Shahs were actually put under the control of the Majlis, which controlled, this is the parliament, all treaty-making and the national economy, including the banking systems. So there was a major economic and social reforms right from the beginning of Iran's constitutional or its revolutionary experiences, beginning 1905, 1906, with what I said is a constitutional revolution. This revolution was actually a political movement to handcuff the Shah and to control its own resources. That is to say, it would not be independent, in fact, if foreigners, meaning the British, who were very interested in the oil fields at that time, as well as the Russians. And, in fact, it's the Russians and British that assisted the Shah in fact, weakening the parliament and handcuffing it by 1912. From 1912 to 22, there was a 10-year period of hiatus. And then the Shah, the second Shah for the 20th century appears, that is the second families of Shahs, the Pahlavis, with the assistance of the British. So it wasn't 1953, it wasn't the first coup against a leader. In this case, it was an appointed leader, a military man who was in the hands of the British who came to power and who essentially overthrew the previous approximately 120 years of rulers at the time called Qajars, the Qajar Shahs. Now, from the 1920s on, one had the Pahlavis. The father came in 1920, and then the son was put on the throne in 1941. Again, it was an outside power that put the son in power. So one can begin to trace the intervention of the British and the Russians against the Constitutional Revolution as the first of the several outside interventions into Iranian politics. Iranians wanting a democratic and independent country, and they wanted to control their own resources. They wanted their own banking system. All this was being interfered with, initially by the British and the Russians, and then by the British in full course with the coming of an entirely new monarchy. It was opposed by certain religious leaders, by the way, that is to say the coming of the Pahlavis in the 1920s. But by the 40s, the United States and Britain, particularly Britain and Russia, were not happy with the old man, as he's called, Reza Shah Pahlavi, and he was exiled out of the country and dies later in Cairo. His son, Mohammad Reza Shah, which everybody knows as the Shah, actually, of Iran up till 1979, is then put on the throne by a combination of British, Russian, and American interests. And he remains on the throne until he's overthrown by a popular uprising around the issue once more of controlling a national resource, that's to say oil, which was, of course, selling and becoming extremely important on a world market for industrialization of the global economy. By the 1950s, oil would clearly assist Iran in its economic and social reforms that were being argued by Dr. Mossadegh and the Popular Front. He was so popular and was elected, indeed, in 1951. By 1953, the combined efforts of the British, some Iranian agents, as well as the CIA, in what we know as the CIA-assisted coup of 1953. That has just been acknowledged, finally, in 2013, as a 60 years later, as, in fact, a CIA operation. It was assisted, of course, by the British and by their previous 4 to 5 attempts to overthrow the Shah between 1951 and 53. I mean, to overthrow Mossadegh in that period of time. So Mossadegh is placed under house arrest after 53, and the controlling power is now the United States, sometimes referred to now as the coming of the American Shah. By 1960s, there is increased difficulties in Iran, and the United States is assisting the Shah in a reform program called the White Revolution, particularly the land reform, which, though, had some independent origins on the Iranian side. So that the United States remained an important factor in supporting Mohammad Reza Shah, who was cooperating with the United States and sharing its own land space and airspace with the United States for surveillance of Russian missile systems in the north. There also was cooperation with, after 1953, that the entire oil company that had been British Petroleum or British the Iranian British oil company had now become the British Petroleum Company, and British Petroleum, though, because of the role of the United States in the coup, had to give up half of its control of the oil fields of Iran. So the United States is a partner now in interventionism into Iranian politics, which continues. Now we're covering already something like 60 years to 70 years of running history of continued intervention for the reason of seizing Iran's resources primarily, but now using Iran land space for purposes of surveillance of the Soviet Union, and of course using its port facilities was an extremely important factor in Iranian policies and politics in the Persian Gulf. By the 1970s, an independent movement is rising that is a combination of religious leaders and secular leaders as well, mainly young students who had become, who were part of both liberal and radical or socialist movements, both Islamic and secular. People were involved in that coming out of the universities. This begins with the movements once more renewing, as it were, the third time around from 1905 now to 1953. In the 1970s, there's a third round, as it were, of revolutionary social political movements now in Iran. Again, these are not neophytes. So people who went through two attempts to control their destiny to finally, by 1979, the Shah actually is removed. So it's considered the third try by the Iranians to carry out a successful control of their own destiny. This fell into the hands, however, of the religious powers, who were, by and large, the only leaders left within the Iranian politic or civil society as it existed, such as it existed in the 1960s and 70s, as the leftist movements as well as liberal movements were constantly being handcuffed, curtailed, and then imprisoned. So there does emerge an Islamic Republic, that is an Islamic Revolution, as it were, the only opposition in the field. So in a sense, it was clear that one could make an argument that the United States helped prepare the coming of the Islamic Republic. It began, however, as a populist, cross-class, massive national movement in 1977 through 79. Many of the left referred to the events after 79 as a hijacking of an Iranian revolution and the coming of an Islamic revolution. We can begin dating from 1979 on, therefore, the coming of the Islamic Republic right up till the present. That's a quick brief overview, but the point that I'm making is that the Iranians are not newcomers to revolution. Primarily have been urban political movements that have been increasingly both spontaneous initially and then extremely well organized through the 50s, through the 70s, till finally the revolution succeeded in changing the dynasty and not having another appointed leader by outsiders. Some make the point, though, that the Islamic Republic was indirectly appointed as the path was cleared of all possible opposition by the Pahlavi-supported U.S. government that was in Iran until 1979. The Shah was the one who was in charge. The U.S. Department of State clearly makes that clear through its statements from the 60s and on, that it could not control the Shah, which doesn't make any sense at all, because they controlled him very much. Iran was actually under an American military presence as well, because there were a series of very important military advisors that began in 1941 with the coming of a man by the name of Schwarzkopf. Yes, that's the father of General Schwarzkopf of the Gulf War of 1990, who was in fact in charge of the New Jersey State Police. He founded what's called the Gendarmerie or Genmesh mission during World War II, which was to disarm the countryside, that is to say tribal peoples, such as the Kurdish people, of arms and to support the Shah. This military mission became the Military Advisory Group by 1951 and then was joined together with a previous one and called Army Shmag by the 1960s. There was a third group brought in 1970s. So behind the scene, unknown meant to many Americans, unless you were actually in Iran, living in Iran, and talking to Iranians, there had been a history of American intervention that it was increasingly involved in the running of the Iranian government, including the Ministry of Agriculture, which was supposed to have been so heralded in the 1970s as an independent portion of the government. But in fact, the Minister of Agriculture frequently had to consult with Americans as to how to carry out that land reform. There were, in addition to that, these military advisors who were running the Iranian military and intelligence operations, including the very highly sophisticated instruments in the northern part of Iran, which were look-up systems to intelligence operations such as the U-2 Gary Powers missions overflying southern Russia and spying on Russian technology. Now, the important point here is that while we saw the external presence of the United States with the frequent visits and the close friendship of the Shah from the 1950s on, with a number of the presidents, U.S. presidents, including Eisenhower, and then on into the 60s with Kennedy, and then, of course, also into Carter's administration, finally, where there was a toast made in 1977 in Washington, D.C., it was made in Tehran between Carter and the Shah when the Carter toasted the Shah for maintaining an island of stability in a sea of chaos, as it was termed. So the the U.S. presidents have been very much attached to the Shah, as well as to the running of Iran and intervention in its affairs. Little things should also be noted, I could say. The airplanes, for example, the Iranian military air force, completely trained by the American Air Force. They all went to the academy out in Colorado. The Iranian cadets did. They had to speak English to control towers. The control towers are operated by Americans, not Persian. The dominance of the predominance of American culture was clearly being seen through the 70s, but also in terms of this important role played by English in the operations of the Iranian infantry and also, of course, its air force and navy. So it was an Iranian U.S. armed forces, certainly from the 50s on into the 1970s, when the revolution came. So Iranians consider this a revolution not only against the Shah, but against U.S. intervention. That came as a result of the Mossadegh overthrow. When the Shah was restored, the young Shah was restored, Mohammad Reza Shah, restored to power and to the throne by a U.S.-assisted coup, what we call a CIA-assisted coup. So the history of relationships between U.S. government and the Iranian people has not been a good one, to put it mildly. The Peace Corps' arrival in the early 1960s, certainly an eye-opener for young Americans such as myself, as to what was happening on the ground and the importance of the military advisors that we would run into constantly in our schools and cities that we were in, both out in and outside of Tehran. Certainly the presence of the Shah and the way he behaved towards the people, that is to say, increased imprisonment and silencing of leftists and of demonstrations, all of which become certainly even minor in scope to the present Islamic Republic's crackdown in 2009 of the, first of all, the protest against the elections in June of 2009, and then the November re-demonstration against that election, which was an artificial election that had been, in fact, it was a mockery of elections that Iranians had had before. So that, and was repressed violently by the present Islamic Republic, far beyond any violence that was imposed by the Pahlavi regime against any street demonstrations from the 50s through the 80s. So the present government itself has inherited a people who indeed are experienced in and have a collective memory of past and present struggles for independence in controlling their own resources, particularly oil, in maintaining their own liberties, including demonstrations and civil liberties and human rights. It's not at all in the same ballpark as Iraq or Afghanistan. So as you had mentioned at the end of your comments, Gary, that the United States is indeed contemplating a possible attack on Syria, which would draw Iran into that conflict without question from most specialists' point of view, and maybe indeed a bombing of nuclear sites, as the nuclear issue is again another method of controlling the regime by outside forces. We create it as a nuclear crisis, but for Iranians, it's a regime change activity, which goes back to the British and Russians interfering with the Constitutional Revolution in 1911 and 1912, again the United States with the British in 1953, and then even attempts to intervene through the 70s and 80s in the choosing of their leaders and in the maintenance of their political culture.
Thank you for that very detailed overview. A follow-up question.
Okay.
Everything you have stated is simply a matter of historical fact. It's just now been officially recognized. However, what I'm about to ask you is purely speculative, but it is speculative with some caveats. Do you believe that there will be an attack against Iran at some time in the near future, instigated by Israel? And has it not been the case that Israel has had a hand in creating the policy against Iran and against Syria and some other countries, including Turkey, in that area of the world? And they have enormous influence. AIPAC, the Jewish lobby, has enormous impact over the every single politician seems just to bow down and kiss their ring. You never hear anyone being critical of them and how they operate. And so here are my questions.
Okay.
A, do you believe that there will be a conflict? B, if there is a conflict, I believe that the conflict will be much more substantial than just taking out a nuclear power plant, because they know that Iran would not tolerate that. Iran is a sovereign nation, and it's not been proven that they've had nuclear weapons, and I don't trust any of the intel that's coming out. Like, I don't trust anything that's being said now about Syria. I don't believe that it has been proven at all that Assad's regime was responsible for the chemical or weapons that have been used, because we know the Saudi news agencies, the Saudi influence of its Sunni persuasion against the Shia in Syria is substantial. So once again, if you have the Israelis or the United States backing the Israelis go after Iran, I see this as being rather substantial. This would be a war in the Middle East on steroids. I believe that Israel would have to take out everything they could, their air force, all their munitions, their navy, tiny as it may be, and any and all of the Hezbollah, any and all of the Hamas offices, any and all of the People's Revolutionary Committees, they would take out everything, in my opinion, because they don't want to leave anything left that could be a counter reaction to them. But when you look at the size of Iran, Iran's 2.5 times the size of Iraq, and you look at the size of their people under arms, and you look at the nature of their theocracy, I don't believe that it would be a, what did Donald Rumsfeld say, you know, a walk in the park, a cakewalk to win. And I don't believe that that would be the case. I believe that they've already had multiple plans for what would happen when this occurs and how they would fight not just Israel, but also Saudi Arabia. And they would also cause destruction of the oil coming out of the Middle East and through the Straits of Hormuz, which could cause the price of oil on a speculative market to go to at least $200 to $300 a barrel, which would mean our gasoline would suddenly be costing $15 to $20 a gallon, which means the price of food and travel and everything connected with utilities would increase exponentially. Mm-hmm. And the average American is just clueless on any of this because they don't believe that anything bad would happen, that we are going in there to stop tyranny, stop nuclear proliferation, and we would correct it and we would be backing Israel. That's all the average American knows, because that's what Glenn Beck says and Sean Hannity says. Even many on the left say that. I'd like for you to give us your perspective on this now.
Well, again, you give me a good order, a big order to talk to, Gary, but I'm happy to take apart some of the issues you've raised, which are very, very important. First of all, American people, I would hope, would begin to appreciate Iran's history of revolution and social politics, social movements on a national basis. I'm not talking about one or two, three cities or a half a dozen portions of the provinces. I'm talking about the nation of Iran has had this collective history of social movements of demanding high political aspirations of independence and liberty for themselves and for their colleagues. The second important point is the size of Iran, as you had mentioned, is also completely misunderstood. It's clearly more than 3 times the size of Iraq, by the way. We're talking about a country that is the third largest country in the Middle East after Turkey in landmass. It's actually the largest country just after Saudi Arabia. So in territory size, it represents an overwhelmingly more difficult strategic or military operation to maintain or to maintain a continuous assault on and to in any way attempt to control it. By the way, Iran has never been controlled by any one single power. Iran has had a history of empires and go back to the pre-Christian era, if one remembers one's history. So, in fact, the Iranians are well prepared to answer any kind of outside threat. Also, with a population of more than 70 million people, Iraq is somewhere between 15 to 18 million people. So we're talking about a country that has nearly 6 or 7 times the number of people that the United States and Israel would have to confront. It is clearly a, as they said, a horse of another color. It's a It's a object of military assault that is in completely another dimension. Besides the impact, as you begin to mention, of any kind of assault on Iran, Iran, and by the way, Iranians boast about this, whether it's possible to do is another question, that they can raise an army of 10 million in 2 weeks. That may be the case under an Islamic Republic, which draws upon other aspirations and goals for people, as it did during a very treacherous and a disastrous war against Iraq, which started in 1980 and continued in 1988, and only served up Iran of 500,000 people who were first dead, and then well over 2 to 3 million people who were crippled, and in fact delivering a huge blow against Iranians and against Iraqis' labor forces. But it doesn't, that's been 20 years ago, almost 30 years ago, and the memory is quite fresh to Iranians. It's clear that they would react to any attempt on their soil. While we call it an Islamic Republic, Iranians have a deep, deep nationalist pride that they would adhere to, whether they are left, center, or right. There would be a popular uprising within Iran against the present government if they didn't, in fact, react. So one can count on a brand new level of violence coming out of Iran if there's any attempt to bomb and take out, as they use, a very easy word to use, take out the 15 to 20 nuclear sites, more than half of which are underground, and these multiple bomb busters would have to be employed. I don't believe, to answer your first point that you were making, that Iran or that Israel is going to bomb Iran. I don't believe that's going to happen. If it was left up to Israel, it's a different story. But the U.S. military are far more familiar with the Iranians than the Israelis may be, who might have a short memory in this regard, although Israel was intimately involved from the mid-1950s, it's actually 1940s, to the 1970s and 80s in Iran's military and intelligence gathering. In fact, they assisted in the establishment with the FBI of the Secret Service that became notorious in Iran after 1958. We call it SAVAK, the State Information and Intelligence Organization. There was an assistance of Israel was involved in that, in establishing that regime. Now, the Iranians know this. So they know that the role played by Israel and the role played by the United States are not independent of each other, that there's little daylight between the two when it comes to foreign policy. But they also know that the Israel is probably going to hesitate, but they may not hesitate, even if they didn't. The break on Israel's independence actions towards Iran, even towards Syria, although that's another story that we could get into, Israel's activities against Iran has already been going on. There have been military missions sent to Iran, both of Iranians and including Israelis and American underground officers and militia into Iran to collect information to prepare for any possible bombing of Iran and any kind of reaction against that within Iran. But that probably is not going to have much of an effect on any outcome, as the effect of bombing Iran will bring back memories of the Iran-Iraq war. But now it's Israel and its image and the United States, both the combination of two, changed the entire matrix of the game, as it were, or of the players involved. And Iran's reaction would be far more violent and would be more drastic, as you mentioned, the impact on the oil fields, not only in the Persian Gulf area, but in Saudi Arabia and in the Gulf area, where that is to say that region, which is responsible for something in the order of 50 to 60%, if not higher, of the known oil reserve and gas reserves of the world, makes that, pardon the pun, extremely volatile and has multiple impact on the global economy, as you mentioned. That is to say, the rising of price of food, of clothing, the of course, extreme jump, quadrupling in prices of oil globally. The United States may not be affected directly so much by that, as we get much of our oil from combination of Latin America and Africa, and from our own resources. But we do, our allies do depend heavily on the Gulf oil. Now, by that I mean most of the European states, and of course China, and some of the Asian states. So the global implications and ramifications of Iran not just shutting off oil, but taking out oil wells in retaliation to any strike against the nuclear power would be disastrous economically and politically and military-wise, without question. The one can't begin to draw up a speculative scenario as detailed at this time, of course, but we can sense the implications well based on fact and in past performances, and antagonisms between Iran and Israel and the United States go very deep. There's a history, as we say, between the two, between the three, including Israel and the United States on one side and Iran on the other. Therefore, one can expect something not quite cataclysmic as you drew, but nearly as so. And the Pentagon, by the way, is well aware. Generals have made this known at various times over the last 5-10 years that playing around with Iran is just playing with fire and is just plain stupid. That negotiating with Iran on any question, including nuclear issues, is of a high priority. Iranians are a national state. They want to defend their resources and the right to make their own decisions as a sovereign state, as you mentioned, and they will fight to the end to maintain that. They've done so in the past, well over 100 years, and it will continue from the present on. So one can count on a reaction from Iran.
I would also add that you're not just dealing with Iran. You also have to realize that one of the most powerful theological leaders in Iraq is Muqtada Sadr, and he would be supporting Iran, so you could have all forms of sabotage occurring within Iraq. You also have to look at Russia, India, and China and their political support of Iran. And no matter what the United States does, if the United States got 100% of its oil from other countries, it still cannot control OPEC. And what the price of oil would be to other countries within it, which would adverse affect the European Union, people would exploit this, even if it did not become a heavy hand to the United States. It would elsewhere. So I just believe this would be just sticking your hand in a hornet's nest. I just think it's stupid. I thank you for those insights. And I didn't mean to leave you out of the conversation here, Fariba. But when you were on the program last week, one of the reasons I wanted you to return is because letting us know more about your father, his relationship with Mossadegh, because when we think of Iran and we hear people talk about Iran, they never talk about the fact that their first democratically elected prime minister was a man who was uncompromising in his honoring the rule of law, higher ethics, and refusing to play dirty politics. If we only knew as a country what we had gone against and what we had destabilized, then it might give a different perspective today to the evolution of our thoughts on Iran. So could you please take us through more about the man, your father, and more about his friend and the Mossadegh, the two of them, who they were, what they represented, and how had they been able to maintain the democratically elected government, what would be some of the outcomes that we interfered in?
First of all, let me say that Professor Ricks gave a wonderful outline of the history of Iran, history of U.S.-Iran relations, and the outcome of it, you know, throughout the last 60 years. I think Professor Ricks very much outlined this for the listeners. But what we have to understand is that the main reason that Mossadegh became so popular in Iran, there are a couple of reasons. One reason is that, you know, in Iranian history, when you read Iranian history during the last 100 years since the Constitutional Revolution of 1906, he was on the side of the constitutional movement. And he, at that time, he supported the ideals of the constitutional movement, which was mainly that the Shah or the Shahs should reign and not rule. And in fact, he was sent to prison during Reza Shah, who was the father of the last Shah, Mohammad Reza Shah. And there in prison, he became very ill. And a lot of times when we read news stories about Mossadegh or the propaganda against him, that he basically was not a sick man and that he played a role, which is absolutely nonsense. He had major serious illnesses, and one of them was as a result of being sent to a remote area of Iran in very harsh conditions, and he became very ill. So that is all nonsense. That was basically a propaganda by British and later American media, and they used that to basically undermine the ideals of this man who, from the very beginning, at the age of 13, he had become a major leader, and he because of his influence, his family influence, which was the Qajar dynasty before the Pahlavi dynasty, he had become the head of one of the major provinces in Iran. And from the very beginning, he supported and believed in the ideals of the constitutional revolution, which was basically that the Shah must reign and not rule. So his main quarrels with both father and the son was on this very issue. And when he entered the Majlis at the very age, became a member of the Majlis, he basically proposed and implemented many reforms within, you know, for the Iranian society, which today, you know, in democratic societies, and especially, you know, there is a lot of talk about democracy, you know, democratization of the Middle East. Well, Mossadegh talked about this and spoke in the Iranian parliament and implemented many, many laws which were very beneficial for the Iranian society. And this goes back to, you know, before his before he was toppled, which was in late 1940s. As a member of the Majlis, he talked about these things. So this was a man who believed in the rule of law, and he believed in democracy. And the people who were around him, and he was clever enough because he had studied in France and in Switzerland, and he received his PhD in University of Neuchâtel in Switzerland, and he came back to Iran as he was in the words of Professor Ervan Abrahamian, he was a child of the Enlightenment. He saw in the West, especially in Europe, what he wanted to see in Iran. And so he came back to Iran after his studies, and he wanted to bring those reforms to Iran. And the many people who were around him, he thought that by having a front, which was later became the National Front, that the National Front would be a power in Iran, like a party, and it was composed of different beliefs, from very religious to liberal Democrats, and many of the people who, or the majority of the people who were in the National Front, including my own father, were basically educated either in the West or in Iran in very liberal entities, and they were also extremely not only secular in their ideas, but also ethical, which was very rare and has been very rare in Iranian history. You can say that the Iranian people have always fought and struggled for independence, democracy, the rule of law, and all of that, and we see that even today, and that's what they want to see those changes or those ideas to be implemented in our society, in the Iranian society. But when we're talking, you know, about 1950s, these men and a lot of the women were people of the highest integrity. They were incorruptible. They were extremely educated. They believed in the rule of law. They were Democrats. And Mossadegh had this kind of people around him. And one was my own father, who became mayor of Tehran. And first he was appointed by Mossadegh to become the head of national security, because at that time the national security institution was extremely corrupt, extremely, you know, they were paying off people. And so Mossadegh appointed my father because he saw that this man was, you know, had a lot of integrity. And he, you know, he was the first, the youngest judge in Iran at that time. And so, you know, these were the people in Mossadegh's entourage. And my father tried to revamp this institution, and of course he was confronted with people who you know, who were very corrupt, and they wanted him out. So Mossadegh basically encircled himself with people who were who wanted to see the benefit of Iran's oil and industry to be for the people of Iran rather than for foreign powers, whether it was the Soviets or the Russians or the Americans or the British. And he kicked the British, a lot of the British embassy staff out of Iran because they were meddling in Iran. So one of the things that the Mossadegh did was, one of the first things he did was he saw that there were some shady characters within the British embassy, so he kicked them out, and that was very much, the British saw that as a sign of war towards them. And from not in 1953, but long before 1953, and I've mentioned that in my article, that the British were very much involved in Iranian politics, not only bribing members of the parliament, or the majlis, as they say in Persian, but also, you know, giving bribes to various individuals, including members of some of the members of the clergy, and many others, of course. So, from that time, Mossadegh saw the British as the first danger to Iran. But it is not enough that he confronted the British, and this is where I think that, you know, I understand from reading Iranian history that Mossadegh was portrayed as pro-communist or pro-Tudeh Party, which was the Communist Party of Iran, leaning towards the Soviet Union. But in fact, even George McGee, who was the main negotiator representing the Truman administration in the oil negotiations, he even says in his own book that Mossadegh was first and foremost an Iranian nationalist, and he was the first member of the Iranian parliament who nationalized the northern part of Iran, which is near the Caspian Sea. He nationalized the fishing industry there. So he was staunchly anti-communist as well. And in my father's memoirs, which has not been published yet, but you can, I mean, Persian speaking can still, you know, can read them online. He mentions that when he went to visit Mossadegh after he was exiled to his estate, he would say that I will never let Iran be under communist or Soviet influence, and I will never give in to any kind of foreign influence in Iran, whether it's the Russians or the Soviets or the Americans or the British. So it is preposterous to say that Mossadegh was toppled because he was going to be a partner with the Russians. That is absolutely nonsense. And one other thing is that, you know, we talk about, I think I spoke a little bit about that last week, the new information from, the information that has been released by the CIA. But, you know, the CIA, basically, both Madeleine Albright and Obama, and even, you know, some of the British politicians have acknowledged the role of their governments in toppling Mossadegh. So I don't think there is anything really new about this, you know, this declassified information. I think it may be the timing for various reasons, maybe political reasons. The CIA has finally acknowledged its role in toppling Dr. Mossadegh's government.
I don't believe that is what is significant. What I believe is significant is that in preserving Ronald Reagan's legacy and even the Democrats with Jimmy Carter, they have tried to maintain this lie that they had no hand, our administration, previous administrations, in the destabilization, in a coup there. So now they can't say that, which then throws open the whole idea that these administrations have also been engaged in the destabilization of other countries, and they have had the CIA work in creating coups in other places. So it's a game changer, and now it will be up to the scholars and those who are most knowledgeable, such as yourself today, and our other guest here, Professor Tom Ricks, to then rewrite what, from an official point of view, what they have suspected or we have known all along, that we have illegally, against the Geneva Convention, against the UN Human Rights, against all of the Nuremberg laws, we have been engaged systematically in undermining, through regime change, every administration in the world that did not in some way benefit our political or economic interest. That's what this means, and we'll take it from there. One last question for you, because we're going to run out of time and I need a short answer from you. During the reign of the Shah, Iran was considered the most secular of Muslim nations. Now, aside from the Shah's dictatorial rule and all the hundreds of thousands of people that he arrested, the thousands he caused to be killed, the thousands he exiled and tortured, wasn't it also during his regime that Iran managed to progress in sciences, medicine, engineering, and other technologies, and thereby surpass other Muslim nations? And if that is the case, then shouldn't we have a different perspective of the United States today, because we then stopped all of that progress and look where we're at today with this extremely ramrod, rigid, almost inflexible modern theocracy in Iran today, and we have to be responsible for taking the position that we helped create that. Your final thoughts, please.
Right. I just want to make a very short comment that absolutely the toppling of Mossadegh was not just about oil, but about U.S. and other Western powers' influence in Iran. And I just want to give you one example, which, you know, I read in a very, very detailed article about the sale of arms to Iran during the Shah. The Johnson administration was refusing to sell arms to Iran. And guess who became the intermediary to make sure that the Johnson administration would sell the arms that the Shah wanted? Because basically the Shah became the major arm buyer in the whole Middle East from the U.S., and it was Kermit Roosevelt. Kermit Roosevelt became,
related to Teddy Roosevelt, not Franklin Roosevelt.
Kermit Roosevelt was a CIA man in Iran. He's the one who the Shah said, I owe my throne to you, Mr. Roosevelt. Kermit Roosevelt was, or Kim Roosevelt, was the grandson of Theodore Roosevelt. And he was the main CIA person in Tehran at that time. And he became later the president of the Gulf Oil Company. And he actually advised and finally made sure that the Johnson administration would sell the arms that the Shah wanted, because the Shah just wanted it all. He wanted the F-16s. He wanted everything that the U.S. Was producing. So it was, you know, the reason, I think one of the reasons that Mossadegh was toppled was not just because of oil, but also because Mossadegh, in his meetings with George McGee, he asked for assistance and basically wanted the U.S. Government to sell agricultural stuff to Iran. And instead of giving that to Mossadegh, they topple him with the British help, or the British and the Americans both toppled Mossadegh government, but they made sure that Iran become the major purchaser of arms, the major purchaser of arms in the Middle East. And of course, as Tom mentioned, all the military advisors who were in Iran, and you know, the great influence that the U.S. had in Iran during the Shah's time. To come back to your question about, yes, you know, history is not black and white. I think we have to read between the lines. And of course, my father was jailed 6 times during the Shah, and many liberals, many leftists, many religious people, religious leaders were jailed, and there was torture, and there was imprisonment during the Shah's time. But I don't think that the Iranian economy did prosper under the Shah. There was a middle class during the Shah. Okay, there's no question. But if you look at Iran today, and there was
Hello? Oh, we have a bad connection. Fariba, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for being with us. My guest, Fariba Amini, and the journalist, and also Professor Tom Ricks. Just one quick final thought before we sign off here, and that is that when we look at the Middle East, we have to also look at its people. We have to look at its size. Look at Iran. It's larger than Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Israel, and Lebanon, and Jordan, Kuwait combined. It is principally a Shiite nation. And from what I know of the Shiite Persia, throughout most of its history, it has showed far more tolerance and compassion towards other religions than have the Sunni nations. And unlike its Arab neighbors, the mystical qualities of Islam, such as Sufism, and certainly the extraordinary Persian mystical poetry, with its emphasis upon love and equality and tolerance, such as Hafiz, Rumi, Sa'di, Uttar, Omar Khayyam, and so many others, have been more integrated into Shia. And therefore, when we then cause through our interference the Ayatollah Khomeini and his revolution, and that saw this rich history of Shiism grow into more fundamentalist and intolerant, and in some respects similar to Saadi's Wahhabism, and hence remove its historical legacy, I think we have to blame ourselves for that as well, because we help contribute to it. Thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Knoll. This has been the Progressive Commentary Hour.